The following message was recorded at an event hosted by Desiring God. More information about Desiring God events, conferences, and resources is available at www.desiringgod.org.
Dr. MacArthur, thank you for your message that was biblically encouraging. Thank you. I want to ask you two, when you met each other for the first time, or when did you become aware of each other's ministries? Do you remember?
I think I remember. He wouldn't remember. Of course, I met him at 12:30 KTIS AM or whatever. There he was screaming away years and years ago. And I didn't like this guy. He was just too harsh for me. And and he came to speak at Bethel. Whether it was a Founders Week or something, and we had breakfast together with John Salehammer. And that's the first time we ever met. And I asked you the question, I'm trying to remember why I asked you this, whether I was thinking at that point about just leaving and going to Bethlehem, but because I don't remember the date. If you were starting over, how would you make sure evangelism happened in your local church, since I saw you as an expositor instead of an evangelist, and you said the first staff member I would add would be an evangelist. So that's my memory of our first encounter.
It was at
a restaurant that I think has gone defunct somewhere up in New Brighton.
You remember the year?
Would have been at the end of the 70s.
Yeah, he's right. I don't remember that. I hate to say that. But there was a real highlight in my life, and he was a part of that highlight. And he mentioned it early when I wrote the Gospel According to Jesus, I was so exercised because that no lordship theology was coming out of the heritage that was my heritage, you know, in that sense. And when I wrote that book, I didn't know anybody outside of that group, really. And I didn't know how this book would be received. And when Jim Boyce agreed to write a foreword and you wrote an endorsement, that was absolutely stunning to me because I was really not moving in reformed circles at that time. I was a leaky dispensationalist, and that was my world. And I realized that I was much more one of you than I was one of them. You know, so I was so overwhelmed that John gave such a good, encouraging endorsement to that. And that's when I first, and of course I, from then on, you know, I've read and followed your ministry with joy, gratitude. And another one of the little highlights of my life was when we had a little meeting down in Louisville and John got the assignment to pray for me. And I was so blessed just to have him pray for me. I'll never forget that. Mm-hmm.
You talked about your father in the beginning of your message, and I was looking this morning at the dates of your two fathers' lives, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Jack MacArthur, 1914 to 2005, Dr. Bill Piper, 1919 to 2007. It's almost the exact same lifespan. Both doctorates, honorary doctorates from Bob Jones, both Baptists, both traveling evangelists. Just if you could both talk about the examples, the lessons that your dad, that you remember specifically from your dad of faithfulness and endurance, particular things that stick out to you that have impacted your ministry and life.
When you say that, I would just love to have heard your dad. I don't think I ever did. But I probably should just say a little bit and then you say a little bit. I mean, we'll keep talking, but I could talk forever about my dad. The main distinctive about my dad's evangelism is that it was so doctrinal. He was a Bible saturated in the dispensational school, but so doctrinal, which is why he was different. So he did his evangelism by developing the doctrine of regeneration, or the doctrine of hell, or the doctrine of heaven, or the doctrine of repentance. That's the way he thought. And so I grew up assuming that's the way you handle the Bible. That's what you do. Even if you do evangelism, if you shepherd a church, you take the Bible and you find what it means across its terrain and its coherency, and that's what reality is. So it was an awesome privilege to grow up in a home where my dad would leave for 2-3 weeks. If he crossed the country in those days, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, come home for 4 days, 8 days, leave again. And just one other thing is a lot of people, I feel like I've got my back to you folks. A lot of people get bent out of shape at dad's this or that. And I never, ever resented my father's ministry, though he was home a third of the time. Ever. It seemed like an awesome privilege to me. And I think the key there was that my mom loved his ministry. She never badmouthed him. She never said, "Where is he? I never come somewhere." Never was there any of that. So I just, growing up, you assume dad's got a call on his life. This is it. My job with my mom is to back him up. And when he comes home, he tells the stories of the victories of the gospel and what could be better. He also brought jokes with him. We'd sit at the table and he'd give me his latest joke.
Well, again, it's a very hard thing for me to jump in. I think the thing that always stood out in my mind was how, just on a personal side, how much my dad loved my mother. It was just a treasure to me. I learned how you're supposed to love your wife. He just loved her, and he loved his children in a unique way. Very endearing qualities. He also was an evangelist with Fuller Foundation, with Charles E. Fuller, traveling evangelist around the states. He was an evangelist at Moody in the years of William Culbertson when he was president at Moody. I think it was Culbertson. Anyway, somewhere in there. And he traveled all over in citywide meetings all over the Midwest and the East. He graduated from Eastern Seminary in Philadelphia, so he had all kinds of Eastern connections. So I had the same kind of experience as a kid living in California with my dad going away for long periods of time on the train and doing citywide meetings and meetings here and there. And he even went overseas a couple of times to do some meetings. And like you, I never resented that. It was just a wonderful thing when he left and a wonderful thing when he came home. But eventually he became a pastor, and I had the privilege from my high school years on, junior high on, to sit under his ministry. And he was an expositor through Matthew, through Romans, through John, and always with an apologetic bent. He was always leaning hard on evidences for biblical veracity, always trying to answer the critic and answer the person who had reasons not to believe the Bible. So everything was laced with that. And that became the predominant emphasis of his radio ministry in the last years. He was on the radio, Voice of Calvary, for 60-some years. So he was faithful. And he used to start the program by playing the marimba. He played the theme at the beginning and the end and preached in the middle. So,
my mother played the marimba for my dad.
Did she?
Yeah. Hold two sticks in each hand?
Yeah, that's right.
And her arms would shake right here.
Sorry, man. Now, you're supposed to cover that up if it's doing that.
I think that's going to end up on YouTube. Did your fathers both want you to be pastors? Did they ever express that desire that you would? I mean, you have five generations of pastors.
Well, my father never put pressure on me to be a pastor. He never, he loved the ministry. He loved the church. He We never had the church for Sunday dinner or anything like that. He loved the church. He loved the people in the church. He loved to preach. He loved to read and study. He was just a voracious reader. He just loved his ministry. And so I grew up with a man who loved everything he did. And yet he never put any pressure on me, because he always felt that only the Lord can do that. And he didn't want to cloud my thinking, because I had such great respect for him. I think he backed far away from that. But the time came in my life through a car accident when I was 18. I got thrown out of a car and went about 120 yards down the middle of the highway and survived 3 months in bed. That was the time when the Lord really got a hold of my heart. But he never put pressure on me. But once I committed to that, then I became his personal project. And then he got serious.
Do you remember the conversation you had when you told him you felt called the gospel ministry?
Well, I don't remember the exact conversation, but somewhere around there, he gave me a Bible, and he just wrote in it, "Dear Johnny, preach the word, love Dad." He just wanted to say one thing to me, and that was what he wanted to say: preach the word. And we had that conversation about 2 Timothy 4, about preaching it all the way to the end and being faithful to the end, because that's how his father was, and that's the goal that he wanted for his own life. I was basically a football player jock in my high school days and even in college, and he dragged me off to seminary. And he said, you got to go to seminary. You got to get serious and go to seminary. And you need to go to Talbot Seminary, because there's this guy there named Charles Feinberg. You remember the name? Who was brilliant, studied 14 years to be a rabbi and was converted to Christ. Two earned doctorates. Went to Dallas Seminary, got his Ph.D. President of Dallas was Chafer in those days. And he said he was the only graduate they ever had who knew more when he got there than he did when he left. So I'm not sure. I don't know what he meant by that, but that they had a negative effect on the poor guy. And so he left there and went to Johns Hopkins and did a Ph.D. Under William Foxwell Albright, who was a great Middle Eastern archaeologist, and he knew all kinds of languages. And so my dad had worked a deal with Feinberg to take me on as a personal project while I was in seminary, which he did. And he gave me books, and this is just a quick story. He called me into his office periodically in honor of my dad. I know he didn't tell me he was doing it because of my dad, but I know my dad was behind the scenes trying to shift my mental focus. And he would give me books to read, and he would have conversations with me, and even was in his home. I became a good friend with his son Paul, another good friend with his son John. And we spent a lot of time together. I had to preach my first year in seminary, and in chapel before the whole student body, and he chose the text, and he gave me 2 Samuel 7, the great Davidic promise. And, you know, I preached on presuming on God. Nathan said, go build it, and God said, Nathan, I don't want him to do it. He's a man of blood, and so forth. And I preached on presuming God, which was like a massive missing of the point, because the point was the Davidic covenant, not presuming on God. That was trivial. So...
And he pointed that out.
Oh, when I finished, he gave me a sheet, and he wrote in red, "You missed the entire point of the passage. See me in my office." And I went into the office, and he—I'm telling you—he shredded me as only he could. And that was the greatest lesson I ever learned. It really was. To get the point of the passage is, it's all we're asking out of you. So that's all we're asking. We don't want your creativity. Just get the point of the passage. So when he went to be with the Lord some years ago, his family called and asked if I would speak at the funeral. So I guess somewhere along the line, he told somebody that he thought I was getting the point of the passage. They felt free to ask me to speak.
John, do you remember the time when you wrote a letter to your father telling him about your decision to go into pastoral ministry? Is that right?
My dad never, in my memory, urged me to be a pastor. In fact, when I
chose to leave teaching in 1979 and head to the pastorate, he wrote a page and a half to dissuade me. Because after being in 1,000 churches, he was afraid for me. He just said, you have found your niche. You are, I wanted to name you Peter, but your mother wouldn't let me name you Peter Piper. We named you John, and that's who you are. You're the quiet, reflective type. You're not the proclaimer, and so you belong in the classroom. So stay there because you're going to be eaten alive in the church. That was the letter, and I couldn't resist the call. And when I said, Daddy, I think I'm going to do this anyway, he said, good. I just wanted to make sure. that was the approach that he took. He took that exact same approach when we were about to adopt a little girl when I was 50 years old. I said, I'm going to adopt a little girl. He wrote me a page and a half letter. Said, that's the stupidest thing you ever did in your life. You're 50 years old. The kids are gone. What in the world are you doing? And we couldn't shake that either. And after that was done, he said, she's beautiful. I love this little girl. So... my dad, I guess, has a different way of encouraging in ministry. He really thought I had found my niche, and I think he was wrong about that.
Did your dad get to hear you preach a lot?
A little? Not a lot, but some. Yeah. Yeah, not much.
You were 34 when you came to Bethlehem.
That's right.
And you were 30?
29.
29. So if you could go back now and talk to the 34-year-old John Piper, the 29-year-old John MacArthur, knowing what you know now, what do you think would be the most important thing to tell them, tell you on the front end of your ministries?
Well, it's clear to me that the most important things would have to do with my children and my wife and not the church. I don't think I would do anything basically differently at Bethlehem. If I thought real hard about it, I might think of some tactical changes. But I think we work out of a pastoral model that's so simple, it's hard to change it. You know, it's just you open the Bible and you tell people what it means with all your heart and try to live it out before the people and figure out the other stuff as you go along. But the family, I could do better. I could really do better as a dad, I think, if I started over again. Nobody was talking in terms of shepherding a child's heart in those days. You know, it's a book title. If y'all don't know that title, I don't think I did very good at that. In fact, give you an illustration I got an email from Nathan down there today. In it, you quoted Rick Gamache, who's pastor of a Sovereign Grace Church here in town. And Rick had done my class for me last Thursday and had told these guys about questions that he asks his children to draw out their heart. And I read those 10 questions or so. I copied them down. I sent them to all four of my sons. They've all got kids. And I don't want them to do as poorly as I did. I think I was faithful to my kids. I went to all the soccer games. I tucked them in at night. I set an example for them. I had devotions every night. But I rarely drew out their affectional life at age, say, 13, 14, 15. And that has not set them up to be as effective, I think, in their lives as they might have been. So... I would go to the John Piper at age 34, I think, and I would say, do better at supplementing your truth commitments with drawing out your wife's heart and drawing out your child's heart so that they find ways to express what's in here, not just what's in here. And I think I was naive about that because... all that stuff sort of comes naturally for me. I mean, I'm an emotional guy. easy for me to express emotions, positive, negative. I'm all over the map. But it doesn't come naturally. You have to, I think, draw it out. So that's the first thing that comes to my mind because it feels big now. And the boys are all grown. I've still got Talitha, which is a wonderful gift that I can now. That's why I copied these 10 questions down because, all right, she's 11 and it's not too late.
Well, I think there's some of that with me. There was a lot less introspection spiritually going on in evangelicalism when I was 29 and coming into my church. I don't think people thought much about expressing feelings, at least in the world that I lived in. So I would think that would probably be more true of me, too, than it would be in later years. But I think for me that the real challenge when I was 29, I'm not a high-powered, you know, type A steamroller guy, but I'm highly motivated. I don't know whether it's a natural gift or a spiritual gift to organize everything. And I think now I've let all of that go, and there's a natural, like you said, a simple natural flow to the life of the church. But in the early years, I was always trying to reorganize everything and restructure it and just moving people around in different boxes. And they were all willing, you know. They were sure, you know, whatever, try this, try that, try this, try that. And I finally figured out that that's not what you should be doing. And I think the price was paid to some degree with my family because I was so busy doing all the study. And then on top, I was coming up with all these different ways to structure and organize things. And I think I didn't give the time to Patricia in particular. And when even though I was home, preoccupied, trying to stuff so many things in, you know, the joke in our family is, you know, calling Father and they'd wave their fingers across my face, you know, even when I was there. So I wasn't always easy to engage. I think I'm better at it now. You'd have to ask them. I hope I am. I think from the church's standpoint, patience. I've never been really a patient person with myself, particularly when I was young, and expecting everything to happen fast and being disappointed if it didn't happen at the pace that I thought it should happen at. Why can't people figure it out? Here it is. Do it. And, you know, it was Grace Community Church, but it was struggling to be Grace, you know. So I think hopefully I've come to understand that a little better, and there's more patience with people. And, you know, I was mentioning to somebody earlier, you preach the word strong and hard and bold and clear and straightforward and without compromise, and then you apply it with tenderness and compassion and grace and long-suffering with people. In the pulpit, it's clear, it's hard-hitting, it's firm, but when you come down and you shepherd these people, that's where you have to express in the application of these great truths, the patience that endears them, you love them in the process and move them along gradually. And that's something I had to learn.
I was thinking earlier today about both of you and of everybody in this room. You two probably receive more praise and more criticism at the same time. And just wondering specifically how you personally handle both the reception of praise, which you get a lot of, and the reception of criticism, which you get a lot of. How do you keep from being prideful on the one hand and overly discouraged on the other hand? And how do you process that when a high praise comes into you or a harsh criticism so that you're responding biblically?
Well, you know, that's part of what I want to talk about in the morning, but look, as I said tonight, this whole thing is a mercy. My salvation is a mercy. I'm not worthy of any of this, and I think I'm always amazed that God does what He does. Who's adequate for these things? As we were talking about, I think you just have to deal with things honestly, realistically, in the sense that God is not doing work on the basis of my abilities and my gifts and my power and my insight. This is all I'm just a tool or an instrument. I think part of the benefit of being in the same church for a long time is it reflects back all your strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. If you just go from town to town to town, you might believe your press clippings. But if you have to live continuously with the failures, with the inadequacies, with the weaknesses in your own life that show up, reflected in your people and your family and your kids, and I think there's something real about that. I think it helps to have a wife who knows that praise can be harmful, and without deciding that she's going to be a thorn in the flesh, she can also be the one who pulls you back to reality. But I think, you know, I'm just grateful. When people say kind things about me, I know that they're responding to the teaching of the Word of God and the work of the Spirit through the Word. And I'm just grateful. It always surprises me, and I'm grateful. On the other hand, criticism, I decided a long time ago not to try to defend myself. If the truth were known, I can't defend myself at some points. If you happen to pick the one where I could, I don't want to get in a situation of trying to portray some kind of perfection or answering every critic. I mean, we all have weaknesses. I have errors in my theology. I don't know where they are. If I knew where they were, I would change them, but I don't know where they are. I'm working on it. But I think from the negative side, I just refused many years ago, long years ago, 25 years ago, I refused to defend myself. I just try to do what I do and be faithful and do it and let my life and ministry speak for itself and not run around and try to answer every accusation, every criticism that comes. I understand that they're out there. I don't look for them. Mm-hmm. If they come, I just, I'll write a letter. Sometimes it'll say, thank you for causing me to examine my own heart. I appreciate what you said, and I want you to know that I took it seriously. Thank you. That's about it. So, because those kinds of things, as I'll say tomorrow, you need to embrace those kinds of things, because those things keep you, work to keep you humble.
Yeah, I would just make sure we hear both sides of the word mercy. If praise comes, the doctrine of God's sovereign mercy means that you must channel all the praise to Him, because without Him, nothing would be happening of any eternal significance. So sovereign mercy pulls the plug on the compliment terminating here. It also works for criticism, because what's devastating about criticism is that it seems to undo your standing with God or usefulness in the ministry. And since God gives us ministry by mercy and saves us by mercy, therefore it can't. People can't pull the plug on that, because I can roll not only the burdens of my pressures off onto the Lord, but the burdens of my sin. So I find it very helpful in counseling, and I counsel myself every day, that when somebody is feeling guilt for, say, the suicide of their son or a divorce or whatever, and they ask me, should I be feeling guilty? I say, I don't know, and it doesn't matter. If you spend your time trying to figure out whether you should be feeling guilty, you'll always come up with an ambiguity. So just relax and feel guilty, and then deal with it the only way that you'll be able to deal with it at the judgment day, because I promise you at the judgment day you'll feel guilty. Everything will be exposed. The heart will be laid bare. You'll have no argument at all. Guilty. And if you don't have a solution for that issue now, you may not then. So let's just relax. We're guilty as charged, and now I repent. Now, that's a little bit oversimplification, isn't it? Because some things we're not guilty of that we're accused of. And therefore, we have to have people around us. Maybe that'd be another thing to say. I'm surrounded by people who I pray, I think, are not yes men at Bethlehem. Got a staff, and they hear what I hear, and they can say, yeah, you probably should take that into account. That's got some validity to it. Or they say, blow that away. That we don't see it that way. So having a community really, really matters. And the last thing I would say is, this is kind of a theological paradox that people don't like to hear, but the Lord, I think, works on my pride by letting me sin so much. There's so many words come out of my mouth towards my wife, so many feelings towards people, so many, and that when I'm going my face and do this conscience thing, I don't know how he could say what he said. I have served to this day with a clear conscience. What planet does this guy live on? I just, are you in touch? I mean, there are women in the world. Ever had a thought? Good night. So I think he must mean something like, I keep real short accounts. Or, I mean, a totally clear conscience? Paul, give me a break. Am I being blasphemous here toward the Word of God?
I think he dealt with it.
Romans 7.
He dealt with it. Well, sure, in Romans 7 he said, I do what I don't want to do and I don't do what I ought to do and I'm a wretched man.
And a guilty conscience.
Yeah, but he dealt with it. Yeah. It didn't accumulate.
That's right. So that's the point I took away, is this cultivated secret life of sin. That's the killer. Not that you never have a thought that you're ashamed of or that you never say a word that you're ashamed of. Good night. So anyway, my point was, as I go on my face morning after morning, I got so much stuff to deal with here, I can't be pointing my finger too many, many places. And so when I stand in line down here and people say, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, I know what's going on at home. I know what's going on here. I've got so much stuff to deal with. I'm just saying, amazing, amazing. Like you said, if anybody gets saved, you just want to stand back and feel the thunder.
Both of you, so many young pastors, missionaries look up to you, read your books. As you counsel young men and women on the mission field, it seems like one of the truisms is that circumstances often confirm our calling. And, you know, if you're good at something, fruit often comes with that. You've both had incredibly fruitful ministries. How do you think through the issue of faithfulness and fruitlessness? In other words, somebody is out there, they're in a small church, they're on a mission field, and a year goes by, 2 years go by, there are no converts, seeming no fruit. How do you think through, this might not be your gifting, you need to pull back from that, there's no fruit that's being produced, versus you need to just stick it out for another 10 years, 20 years, 30 years?
Well, there's several ways to answer that question, but first of all, I'm not in charge of the results. And that's the point I'm going to make tomorrow from the text. Paul says, if our gospel be hid, you know, it's hid to the eyes of those that have been blinded by Satan. I can't overpower that. And I learned this as a football player. You know, I wanted to win the game. Always wanted to win the game. That was the whole point of playing. You don't play to lose, you play to win. So that was a given. But I couldn't guarantee the win. Because there were 11 people on the other side of the ball trying to stop me from doing what I wanted to do, and 10 people on my own team who sometimes didn't do the right thing either. So there was way beyond my capability to achieve the end. So at some point, I determined that all I could control was effort. I could not control outcome. And early in the first year or so at Grace, I had this little kind of motto that I use: if you concentrate on the depth of your ministry, God will take care of the breadth of it. And my ministry hasn't changed since that first year in that small little church. It's all for me about the down and in and depth in the scripture and in my own personal walk with the Lord and all of that. And breadth is something that God does. And I think you've got to come to that Or are you going to frustrate yourself comparing yourself with all kinds of other people and other situations? It doesn't not to say that if nothing happens, God wants you to stay there. He may want you to move. But that becomes a personal decision to be made with much prayer and perhaps some counsel. But I think we have to be content with effort and leave outcome to the Lord. And that's where you're going to find your contentment. And it's like anything else. If you're only content with numbers, then no number will bring you contentment. Because there'll always be somebody who has more, somebody who's more popular, somebody who's more well-known. There's a new fair-haired guy that's attracting the Christian interest. You've got to focus on the issue of faithfulness at the effort to which you've been called. Again, back to the idea of the mercy, and just realize that God rewards that faithfulness.
I think the stories we hear about the Robert Morrisons, he was the first Protestant missionary to China, and this is the 200th anniversary of Protestant missions to China this year, 7 years before his first convert. Adoniram Judson, 7 years before his first convert. David Brainerd, same thing. There's a handful of these guys, and their stories are told over and over again. What's forgotten is that you don't choose to go to the mission field wondering if you will have gifts. Gifts are verified at home before you go. So I presume that the church, the community of believers in which these men were saved and began to mature, spotted in them spiritual gifts. And the function of the church, I think, in the discovery of our gifts and calling is to confirm gifts. And what's confirmed is not a skill that is ineffective. That's not a spiritual gift, I don't think. A spiritual gift is a skill that the Spirit anoints to be effective. The effect is not always just conversion. It's the pricking of consciences. It's the deepening of love for the Lord. It's the correcting of behavior. In other words, if you're in a small, what I tell young people at Bethlehem is if they're trying to discern, what does God want me to do? I say, just start doing what you love to do. Pray down blessing on it and see what people affirm. If you're in a small group, they're going to affirm that you're a helper and lover. You're going to affirm that you're an effective teacher or whatever. And so I presume that these missionaries had some experience where they did some ministry, and it blessed people. And then they had to believe God is for them, he's going to use them, and then they go. And we should be thankful that those early missionaries didn't have airplanes, because they would have been home, perhaps. If you have to get on a boat and ride for 6 months, you stick it out another year, another year, another year. Which may be why today we don't have the same kinds of stories, because it's just so easy to bail now, and it wasn't in those days. So I do think there must be, when it says, let's go see, evidence of spiritual fruitfulness, when an elder must be apt to teach, didaktikos, I don't think that just means he's good at what he does and nobody gets helped. I think the evidence of being apt to teach is lights go on for people. They see things in the Word they hadn't seen. Affections are changed. And he then starts seeing as coming back to him, you've got a gift. That's what happened to me. Seventh grade boys at Lake Avenue Church in Pasadena. Then ninth grade boys. Then the Galilean Sunday school class. Then I assisted Lazor in Greek. And the Word started coming. We understand you. We don't understand Lazor. You help make sense out of this. And I started feeling like maybe that's who I am. My identity arose in community. You can't go into the woods and figure out who you are. It just totally ambiguous. So you stay in the church and you love people and you do what you love to do. And suddenly you start to discover who you are in community.
When you personally get discouraged and want to throw in the towel, where do you go biblically? Is there a particular passage or book that you find yourself returning to over and over and again? And where do you go outside the Bible? Is there a particular author or book that you return to over and over again when you're discouraged or downcast?
Well, I don't tend to be that way. I don't know why. I'm not really a kind of a, I'm not a melancholy type of person. I just move to the next responsibility.
Yeah.
There's no time for me to sit and feel sorry or feel bad. There's too much to do. I'll sometimes get discouraged, but the next task looms large. People have no idea what it is to preach week after week after week after week, year after year, decade after decade, to the same people who have recorded everything you've ever said. And then to speak in chapel at a college and chapel at a seminary and work on a book and do... For me, this is the track the Lord has put me on. I don't have time to sit and, if I have those kinds of moments, fleeting as they may be, I always think of the Apostle Paul, or I think of some of my personal heroes. My mind often goes to William Carey when all of his manuscripts burned. Or it goes to Tyndale, who is a particular treasure in my mind, who's sitting in prison, about to die, and wants somebody to bring him a needle and thread so he can sew up his leggings because he's cold. I've stood by Robert Morrison's grave and cried in China. So I think of, it's not a long process for me because there's just a relentless... I preach Sunday morning one message, Sunday night another message, and usually every week somewhere else another time. So, in one of our ministries. So I don't seem to have time to let those things get me down. And every new opportunity, when I prepare a message, I am so, still to this day, if not more, infused with the thrill of what I've learned and the eagerness to preach that it drags me past whatever the... I even when I preach a really dumb sermon and all I want to do is hide somewhere, the sooner I can start working on next week, the better, because I will leave that behind and I will move into that new opportunity. And for me, it's just getting into the Word and digging down and discovering what I need to know for the next ministry.
The Lord's wired you a little differently.
Yeah, we'll take heart. Not everybody's like that.
I know that.
Yeah, and you're very fortunate. So here's one guy who gets really discouraged. And I got plenty of time to get discouraged. Anything. I pray probably... the prayer, keep me and preserve me, as often as I pray any prayer. And I mean keep me saved, because I think God uses means to cause us to persevere. And I mean keep me in the ministry. I don't want to be one of these short-lived people. And keep me married. Don't want to wreck it that way. And keep me. I pray that. Now unto him who is able to keep you, I pray that blessing down on me a lot, and the Lord has spared me. But stir in this. I'm 61. He's older than I am a little bit. We have passed through seasons, and there is something to men in midlife crisis. I remember sitting in, where was Ben Patterson, pastor out there? Irvine? So he's sitting in Ben Patterson's house. He's on vacation. He's pastor of Irvine. He planted the church. And they gave us their house so if we preach for them on Sunday and have a little week's vacation there. And I remember, I was 40, sitting on the steps halfway through vacation, sobbing. Noel comes down the steps. What's wrong? I said, I don't have a clue. Sounds like PMS. And I just said,
I don't know if I want to stay. I don't know if I want to, I don't have a clue why I'm so sad. And that season lasted several years. And the grace was that I could still function.
It lasted several years?
Mm-hmm. I've met people like him before. I had a church chairman named Roland Erickson. And Roland would ask me, define depression. He didn't have a clue. It was like Gazornenplatt. So if you don't know it, you don't know it. You're okay. Just stay there.
Well, I feel like I'm missing a great experience.
I was listening to an author the other day, and they said, what's the best thing about writing? And she said, the last page. And so what's great about depression is the light at the end of the tunnel. Nobody enjoys being depressed in the middle of it. But one more thing as far as solutions go. I have spent goodness knows how much effort developing a theology of suffering. This conference exists to answer that question. I want to last. I want to stand. I want to get through the discouraging times. I want to help you not be fickle, wishy-washy, drop out, trade your life away, swap wives, leave jobs, trade churches. I just don't want you to be that way. So make a conference. And we're talking about this thing started tonight with these endless sufferings of the Apostle Paul. So he said, I go to Paul and I say, amen, me too. I look at first 2 Corinthians 1, 9, we were so unbearably crushed, that was to make us rely not on ourselves but on God who raises the dead. And I preach that to myself. Here I am feeling that way. I feel like, it's so nice to go to heaven right now. Just let me go to heaven. Noel can take care of Talitha. It'll all work out. Just let me go. And at that moment, if the answer comes back no, if your heart just keeps beating, then you have to do theology. And I'm wired that way anyway. I do theology. I say, God struck Paul down in order that he might not rely on himself, but on the God who raises the dead. He wanted him to be desperate. So you're desperate, so he must have a purpose for you. And I just preach myself through a theology of suffering back into, I hope, more usefulness. So just keep on working on your sovereignty of God peace and your evil of the world peace. That's the greatest issues in life. How can God be sovereign and there be so much horror in the world, including the horror in your own life that's making you so discouraged?
What encourages...
This man has known much suffering. It just doesn't tend to come from within. It comes from without.
I think it's not the things I feel, it's how that processes in me. Because all of the spiritual battles, all the disappointments, all the griefs, all the heartbreaks, I don't know, I'm wired to deal with those in a different way. I can't imagine just sitting and crying and not knowing why I was doing it. But that's not to say that I don't feel the same longings on the inside. It's how they get processed, I think. Because the spiritual battle for me is the same as it is for anyone. And I feel at this point in my life, in many ways, that I've escaped by the hair of my chinny chin chin. That I'm here. But there could have been 1,000 points at which, through my life, it all would have been ashes. It's not to say that that's not a reality or that I'm not aware of that. It's the way I deal with that is different. I don't know why. It's just the way I'm wired, I guess.
As you both think back on your ministries or when you die someday, how do you want people to remember you? What do you want them to say about you? What do you want to be known for?
Do you ever think about that?
Yes. Every funeral. So having thought about it more than he has, I'll give you some time.
I'm not trying to plan my post-death
world. This is not a plan. You don't get to plan it.
No.
But you do get to think about it. I'd like them to say that I was humble, and I don't think they will. I'd like them to say that he was, I'd like all my sons to say he was a really tender-hearted, sensitive, understanding father, and I think they'll say other things. I'd like my church to say he was a really there for us. And I don't think they'll say that. So you might ask them, why aren't you changing your lifestyle? And I've tried, and I'm still working at it. But if they say that he was a means to many people getting a passion for the supremacy of God in all things, for the joy of all peoples through Christ, I'll be okay if that's on the tombstone. I really think that, you know, Paul said, what man says is going to count anyway. One person's verdict is going to matter. So whatever is written on the tombstone will be of small consequence compared to the judge at the last day. And I think what he'll look for is evidence that I was cleaving to Christ for my righteousness and my punishment.
John, do you want to close us in prayer?
Father in heaven, we feel a great need for you, and we love grace. We love mercy. We love the fact that our ministry is given by mercy. Our salvation is given by mercy. Our breath is given by mercy. Our singleness is given by mercy. And our marriage is given by mercy. And our children are given and taken by mercy. We are a people who eat and drink and sleep and breathe mercy. And this is the way we would have it be. You exalt yourself to show mercy. And we're happy to be the beneficiaries while you get the glory and you get the praise and you get the name. We get the joy. Just give us the rest we need tonight, I pray, and strengthen John MacArthur for tomorrow's ministry and Randy Alcorn and Jerry Bridges and Helen Rosevere. We're eager to meet with you again in your word tomorrow. Through Christ I pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message from Desiring God, the ministry of John Piper, pastor for preaching at Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit Desiring God online at www.desiringgod.org, where you'll find hundreds of sermons, articles, radio broadcasts, and more, all available at no charge. Our online bookstore carries all of Pastor John's books, audio, and video resources, and you can also stay up to date on what's new at Desiring God. Again, our website is www.desiringgod.org, or call us toll-free at 1-888-346-4700. Our mailing address is Desiring God, 2601 East Franklin Avenue, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55406. Desiring God exists to help you make God your treasure, because God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him.